Sophia.
And this is Breakpoint Radio, your irregular takeaway of tech news, views, and cafe reviews.
Right, so this week we're breakpointing from the Duck and Waffle, which is over near Liverpool Street Station. We've got Dave and Sophia with us, as usual. And a very special guest with us this week too, of Anne Curry. So Anne, do you want to tell us a couple of things about yourself and what you've been up to, please?
Thank you very much. So I've been knocking around the tech industry for over 20 years now, doing various things. But for the past couple of years, I've been involved in containers and orchestration and microservices. And I was one of the co-founders of the MicroBadger project and the MicroScaling project, which was about custom schedulers for orchestrators like Kubernetes.
Excellent. Okay. And actually, I've been so excited to do this too. I've been trying to line this up for so long. So thank you for coming over as well today. How was the webinar as well that happened the other night? I've asked you before, but...
I did a webinar on called The Rise of the Machines for CodeMotion Amsterdam, a kind of prelim to CodeMotion Amsterdam, which I'll be talking at next month. And it was about what should and shouldn't we automate? Is there anything we shouldn't automate? So I was looking at automation of things like Kubernetes and the orchestrators are astonishingly powerful automation platforms. You can see a future for an awful lot of data centers, operations teams, which involves far, far fewer humans once orchestrators and microservices and containers are kicked in. And we've never handled that very well in the past. We've been automating things for 250 years. And every time we do it, a lot of people suffer. Lots of people put out of work. It moves jobs from what? It always creates jobs, but it destroys a lot of jobs. And often there's not enough help for the people whose jobs have been destroyed moving into the areas where the jobs have been created. And I think it's quite interesting, things like orchestration, because both the jobs will be both destroyed and created within tech.
Right, okay.
But it will involve different skills. So it will be destroying ops jobs, but creating more dev jobs.
Yeah.
So if you were different skill sets.
I guess if you were a new person hitting the market now and looking at a combination of dev and ops roles, what do you think would be the either key technology or key kind of suite of technologies to start getting into to future-proof yourself? Do you think it would be things like AI and ML or different things?
I think it will be programming, not just scripting.
Right. Okay.
So fundamentally, anything where you are used to programmatically real-time responding.
Yeah.
So writing applications that can be automated as opposed to doing things that are in any way manual or even scripted.
Right, okay.
I mean, those jobs will be around for another decade. But it's worth thinking that, you know, in 15 years' time, I think everything will be programmed.
Right. Did anyone get a chance to have a look at things like MachineBox too then, that looked like it was kind of different types of ML and intelligence in a box that you could extend and tailor?
Yeah.
So do you think that's the way things... That feels like it's lowering the bar for programming.
Yeah.
Do you think that's the way it's going, or actually the opposite direction?
Sorry, I'm going to end up talking. You have to stop me from talking. I looked at MachineBox and I really liked it. I thought it looked like a really interesting product. But it also kind of played to something that I'm a bit worried about, generally about automation and machine learning, which is that it's machine learning in a box.
Yeah.
It's a complete black box. You just pass it data and it tells you stuff and it's magic and it goes, this is true, it's magic. We don't know what that means that it's doing underneath. We don't know what underlying assumptions it might be making or what sexist or racist or otherwise non-diverse behaviour from the past that it's bringing, because we don't know, because it's a black box.
Yeah, of course. Okay.
And the face recognition algorithms with very un-PC outcomes came out recently. And so one thing, I dabbled in the machine learning world a little bit in a startup a couple of years ago. And one of the things that we found was we were doing split testing, optimizing split testing. But there's the things that Machine Box are offering are nice because they can be black boxed. So, was it face recognition is one, that's really easy.
Tagging,
that's more interesting actually. I don't know how that works. And then there's sort of nudity detection, which again, it's just like convolutions on an image and you just go yes or no, or blur out this part.
Yeah.
What happens
actually, when... That caused me a lot of problems in a past previous job, which we'll get to afterwards. Okay.
From the point of view of them expanding their business and sort of productizing ML, you get to things like... they're a lot harder, like product ranking or split testing, where it depends a lot more on data that's being passed in. And I mean, a lot of companies are trying to do this, but I think the thing that they lack is this ability to go, here is the black box, you just do this, because you have to go, well, this is how my product works, these are the tags, this is what we want to optimize, and all this kind of stuff. And it's actually integrating it is a lot harder. So yeah, I mean, this is kind of a whole space there.
That's it, please. Great, thank you.
Thank you very much. I use the Google Machine AI image processing thing.
It didn't work. TensorFlow stuff for the...
Oh, I can't remember what it was. You could give it an image and it would like extract the text out, or it would make decisions. So you could give it a picture of a face and it would tell you if it was sad or happy. So we tried it with a few things and it just didn't work. Absolutely didn't work.
Was there any pattern to it working or not working?
Nothing we put in worked, embarrassingly.
Okay.
We put in a picture of someone not
this
wearing
the one
very
when
much.
You draw it with your...
No. This is like you put in a real image. It'll either, so you can do different things to it. So you can extract the text, which would be useful for stuff we do at ITV. Or you could give it different images and it would give you some information about the image, but it just didn't work. We put a partially nude person in and it was supposed to pick up nudity and things, and it just didn't do it, which I guess is a bit dangerous if you're going to be using these things.
Yeah.
Seriously.
What was the thing that you used to be able to draw on the...
That's great.
And it actually detects what it is that you're drawing.
It's a Google thing, wasn't it?
Do you remember that? Or
was it was like Doodle something.
Yeah,
Google
it did.
Doodle.
It was popular for a week.
Yeah.
And then it disappeared again.
It was
cool.
It was really cool, yeah.
So you were saying that you're drawing back to a past job.
Yes. So I think there are a couple of interesting things that about Machine Box. The first is the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulations, that the EU will be going live with in 2018, require you to be able to explain why decisions have been made. So, for things like face recognition, probably not, but those kind of black box AI algorithms aren't going to work so well anymore. They will be illegal within the EU to be applied to EU citizens. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with that. Oh, the other thing was, I used to work for I was head of IT for one of the earliest pure play e-commerce companies called Figleaves.com. We were a lingerie company, international lingerie sales. And we had terrible trouble with getting blocked by nudity detectors from businesses. People actually genuinely did want to buy their lingerie online, and it wasn't, it's a thin line between shopping and soft porn. Algorithms have a good deal of difficulty telling the difference.
There's sort of regulations like the ones we're talking about around safety as well, so having neural networks controlling pieces of machinery and stuff. I have a friend in the sector that I probably can't talk about exactly what it is, but they have problems getting their groundbreaking new automatically controlled systems out there, because then the safety people come back and go, what does this line of code do? And you go, I don't know, it's like 15 coefficients, and it's learned from past experience, trust it, it's better than any rule-based system we could build. No, we can't have that anymore.
Do you know what, a theme that's come up over kind of various podcasts quite a lot in the past has been around privacy and having things like Echo Dot echoes that can pick up on your voice, record it, or Google and where that gets stored, how that gets stored. And do you think that's a concern more and more in the future, or do you think there'll be an actual sway back to just prevent that entirely? Or I find it difficult to see where that's going, but I know that Sophia's talked a lot about privacy concerns with this kind of thing before, so yeah, well, I'm interested to get your take on it. So the floor's open.
You guys can eat while I speak. I saw an interesting thing yesterday that made me think about this question a whole new way. Because I tend to think about it for me, because I always think, well, nobody's going to spy on me, because frankly, I don't do anything that's in any way interesting.
Everything I do is so boring, why would anyone care?
People, just go crazy, you can start spying me as much as you like, why would you bother? But I was reading an article about, did you see this week that there were Sylvia Plath letters about Ted Hughes?
Yeah.
That was sent from Sylvia Plath to her therapist, to a counsellor. And they've come to light, and now everybody wants to publish them and talk about them. And actually, Sylvia Plath wrote a lot about how she really hated how much her life was being intruded on. She didn't want private things that she'd said to be published. This was completely private, utterly and obviously intended to be completely private. But everybody's now desperate to publish it and rake it over and talk about it. And actually, if anybody has any interest in you, your life is kind of no longer your own. And it's kind of, we're terribly prurient, really. I mean, I'm never going to have to worry about this because nobody is ever going to care what I do. But that's not true for anybody, is it?
Well, yeah, you never know, right?
I mean, well, the big difference between being an interesting person and a person of interest. So people can be interested in you just because they see you and they want to know what your general life patterns are. So,
or you could be, you could be misfiled as being someone dodgy, and then everything, every aspect of your life. So one of the things about I guess with all this machine learning algorithms we're talking about, I mean, there's a fairly obvious correlation, I think, that all the really successful machine learning algorithms these days are trained on massive data sets, and they can't be that successful without having all this data collection. So the two go hand in hand. As we automate more, our privacy is going to get eroded away a little bit more by them. Scary stuff.
It is scary stuff.
So actually, something that I did skip over, since I'd last caught up with everyone else here. Oh, Dave, I'm choking. since I last caught up with you two, you went away and did Scarlet, and you did Type Level Summit in New York.
I did.
So, how were they for you two?
Do you want to go? Shall I go?
So, what were you talking about in New York?
So, I wanted to talk about this barrier to tech that seems to still be there. Jessica Kerr talked at the Scarlet Exchange, as we all know, because it was a great talk in 2015 about...
very good. I couldn't remember which year. Okay. Yeah,
no, 2015. About this gap between beginning Scala and functional Scala, and this gap in the middle. And it's something I've started doing the last year, and also more functional programming, and it's quite intimidating, and I just wanted to break that down. So I talked about my learning experiences, what I learned from some of the things that I did, some of the challenges, some resources that I used that might be helpful for people. And I think because the conference was quite a technical one, it was one track, so there was a lot of advanced talks there too. I think people were really, it seemed to be that people were really grateful afterwards to have someone say, it is scary.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry. You don't have to know it all now. There are ways to learn it in your own way. And I think people were really grateful for that, especially at the end of the day.
It sounded very much like it was similar to the kind of Jamie Dobson talk at Scala Days, which starts to break things up. So here's a load of stuff about how a JVM works and how... And then Jamie did a keynote about post-capitalism, which was actually, in some ways, lifts the mood, in other ways, doesn't. But it kind of breaks the... Actually, this was just kind of the hardcore internal virtual machine talking. It's nice to actually have other people talking about ethics in technology, or the rise of automation, or education in tech. It's quite... Yeah. I like that as a mix in the kind of conference schedule. Because otherwise it just gets very...
Too much on your face.
Yeah, tunnel vision and very one-tracked, very siloed. So. Dave, how did you find... How do you even say it? Scala? Scala?
You know what? I've been there. I've spoken there. Yeah. I'm still on. I think it's Scala. I think it's just Scala. Okay. So I did the opposite. I went and gave the first talk at a conference, and it was about metaprogramming in Scala. So, like, about the most technical topic I think I've ever spoken about. And having it as the first talk was possibly not the best idea. No, I tried to make it accessible, but it was a really great conference. So lots of good talks, some really interesting things. John DeGose was talking about a new Quark, yeah, sort of an alternative way of doing Spark-like things, but with pure functional programming. So he started off by had his first slide. It's like, hey, we all like Spark, it's really great, we can do all these things. And his second slide ripped Spark to pieces, and then he built the system up from first principles, which is really, really elegant. There's a lot of other tools which I'm blanking on now. We had a really good workshop as well, actually, about metaprogramming, about Shapeless, which was good fun. Ridiculously oversubscribed.
Yeah, feedback online was good too.
Yeah,
so all the feedback read very well. So.
First trip to Warsaw as well, which is really, really nice, lovely place.
So, I guess, kind of circling back on the education in IT and getting people into Scala from first principles. Anyone read the stuff on explaining programming to six-year-olds too? Yeah, so God, how did you... This taps into a different kind of interest pool of mine, so I'm keen to find out what people thought of that film.
I think it's interesting. I think it was kind of cute, actually, that blog post. But there's a lot of parallels with teaching not six-year-olds as well.
Because you go out and do a lot of teaching and training too.
Right. So, you have this sort of fairly sound teaching principles of, like, repeat things is one way of learning them, and always try to draw comparisons to what people know and all this kind of stuff, which ties back to the functional programming terminology and, you know, words like monads and fixed functors mean nothing until you have an in. And it was kind of that, but, like, with kind of adorable pictures.
Because I think this taps into, like, a shared theme amongst all of us of basically lowering the barrier to tech and making it a bit more accessible and a bit more diverse. So
it's interesting. When I read it, I thought it was a really, really nice article. It was a really, really nice way of introducing people to tech. But I did a hackathon in a North London comprehensive, very mixed right. North London comprehensive, okay. 12 and 13, 14-year-olds last year. And I spent a long time talking to the teachers and the deputy head about what were the barriers to people doing tech careers, the career teachers. And the fundamental barrier was that people weren't even thinking of it as a career. So it wasn't that people didn't know or they didn't... It's just that they didn't know anybody. Nobody's... A lot of what drives people in career directions is apparently what their parents do or what their friends do, what their friends' parents do, what their uncles and aunts do, friends of the family do. And so people have never, ever heard of anybody in the tech sector. Therefore, it doesn't occur to them that it's a potential job. Plus, also, there was a lot of misperception that you couldn't get into tech unless you did a degree. And a degree was very expensive. So fundamentally, it wasn't the right career path for anybody who didn't want to pay for a very expensive degree.
Sure, okay.
So actually, an awful lot of people are being pushed away from tech just because they've never heard of it or because they don't think it's for them. So I thought his thing was really, really good, but actually we need to start even more basically, or it exists as a job.
It's kind of interesting because I think, Sophia, you've had recent experience of your other half finishing with Makers, and actually a whole group of people doing a 3-month intense Maker Academy course and trying to get into tech without a degree. How are they finding getting into the industry?
I think it is difficult because a lot of job adverts do have degrees on them, and I think that is still a barrier to people thinking they can get into it and stuff. I think the 3-month course is good because it does get you in. You get a lot of support and experience in practical things that you would need for a job.
Do they help you actually get into the first role? Because I think it's you do the course and you can be a very proficient developer.
But 3 months is a long time, though.
But
I think there's still this thing with companies. It's quite hard for them to invest in someone who's only had 3 months' experience. But I do think it's good. They do give a lot of support. A lot of the people, there's quite a high hiring rate, which is great. But in terms of me, I didn't know tech was a thing. I completely fell into it by accident, so I completely relate to that. I think having that exposure now, there is more coding in schools, which is great, but it just needs to be more, I think.
So how did you get started with programming then? Because I had a BBC computer in my house when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And so I was just, you know, it was a toy, and so I fell into tech by accident. Because it just was the toy I played when I was a kid. So.
I didn't even know what the terminal was until my first day. So I did maths at university, hated it, and somebody told me that computer science was maths light. Which
the irony.
Yeah, because I know. And I did IT in school, but that's like, you know, PowerPoint presentations and stuff. And my first day, I remember it, my first day in university on that new course, I sat down and they showed me the terminal and I just freaked out. I didn't know what it was, I didn't know what to do, but I couldn't leave because I'd already, you know, wasted that 1 year. So I just had to do it and I really enjoyed it, but I didn't even think about how websites appeared on the web. Like, I didn't even think about it. So I completely relate to people not knowing it's a thing.
It's just like, it's sort of interesting to me that the modern substitute for the BBC that I have as a kid is an iPad, and an iPad doesn't expose this stuff to
no,
you.
No,
so,
not at all.
How did you sort of get into tech?
I did a physics degree, but
good choice, as it happened.
physics degree, an excellent degree, physics degree. But we did quite a lot of programming on the degree, and I did a GCSE in technology. And I had when I was growing up, everybody had a PC. Well, not PC. You had some kind of device. So you had it wasn't in a particular. Yeah, we were pretty. You didn't need to be super rich. Everybody had a game, a console of some description. So I had a ZX81 with 100K RAM pack. Yeah. And you could actually program. In fact, you had to program. You just bought books from you got books from the library with a program in it if you wanted to play it. You typed the whole thing in, played it once, and then completely failed to save it or ever be able to type all the way back in again from scratch every time you wanted to play.
Made you really good at debugging as well, right?
So you were more exposed to the actual nuts and bolts of it. But actually, I think, and in your show notes, was it Glitch?
Yeah, Glitch.
I was really impressed by Glitch, which is a online kind of environment for programming and learning from
Fog Creek, I think.
Fog Creek, yes.
Basically Bootstrap.
I love Trello, hated Bog Bugs. I was so upset because obviously I love Joel Spolsky and all the work he did in the 90s. And Bog Bugs was so rubbish. But Trello is fantastic. But what I really liked about Glitch was it reminded me of Excel in some ways, that what it was saying was, here's something that you know and like and use, Trello, and you can do little twiddly extra bits on it using Glitch.
Yeah.
And actually, I thought that was a really useful thing in the 90s for people to learn basic programming who weren't programmers, which was writing macros and VBA for Excel.
Yeah.
So people could actually do something useful that they'd use every day, and they could see the results, and it was genuine programming. They didn't need to be programmers to do it. And I think, as you say, we just buy all our stuff off the shelf now.
It's so behind a wall kind of thing.
So I didn't look at Glitch. Is this sort of treating programs like little lists of tasks, like little columns of tasks? Or
I only really looked at what it said it did. Yes. And I thought, that sounds good.
So it's basically lots of little bootstrap applications that you can extend to build things like what's it called? Like an Echo program, or some home automation pieces.
Sort of like Automator for the Mac, if you remember that?
Slightly like that. So, lots of little modules that you can then go in and look at how that works and extend it to try and build your own programs. What was the not metaprogramming. There was a whole postmodern programming where you take like elements of different things and basically glue them together to make your program.
So idea comes, of that, the idea comes back a lot. So Lego Mindstorms, that's how you programmed it.
Do you ever remember Yahoo Pipes?
I was trying to think of that.
Back in the day, that was
a little more complicated, possibly a bit too complicated. If this, then that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So cut back, but it's at the light level that people sort of just plug one or two things.
In fact, I think this has got an engine in it for if this, then that, to make that even simpler.
That would be sensible, I think,
All right, jumping into a few more show notes. So the Scala FP stuff, Scala moved over to GitHub. A few different MOOCs out there. There was one on dependent types that looked interesting. Lots and lots of software releases came out since we last caught up. And also that extensive blog post by Paul Snively on FP in Scala, which I think Dave, you'd had a look at.
This relates a lot back to what Sophia was talking about earlier with the type level thing and with, explaining terms to Scala developers. Scala developers are incredibly guilty of using all of the fancy terminology all of the time, and Paul's post here sort of tries to go through the principles of pure functional programming without getting into too many of those jargon terms. It's a good article, and another thing which I found through it, which is really interesting, was a Twitter thread by Bonnie Eisenman.
Oh, right, okay.
I saw that.
From Any Scala, where she was saying, I come to this conference and there's all these terms I don't know, and was sort of listing out the things, and then wrote another blog post, which is, okay, now I've got to look them all up. This is what they are, and this is where you should go to find out about them, which is really nice.
In fact, probably about 5-6 years ago, we did a session very similar to that at Scala Exchange.
Yeah.
We got a flip chart, people shouted out terms that they didn't know, wrote them all down on the board, and then went through and explained them. That might be an idea for other conferences that are coming up on the radar too.
That's a really good idea.
So actually, what is a scheduler? What is Kubernetes? What else is there that's like? There's lots and lots of things like that where people hear the term and think, Terraform. Oh, yeah, okay, what does it... There's lots of things in that space, though, I think, where people get slightly lost.
It is absolutely true, isn't it, that the terminology goes beyond... I mean, I'm used to the word monad being the bad word because it's a... You've got this community where...
It's basically a short word for bogeyman.
Yes.
It's a scary kind of...
Yeah, yeah, but in Scala, we have all of these terms that we borrowed from Haskell. And it's like a compressed space in which this wall of...
It's like a different language if you don't know what you're talking about. If you don't know... Well, I still think it sounds like a completely different language. The example you always use, algebraic data types.
Of course.
That sounds...
Fancy words.
Sounds
so scary.
But this stuff exists outside. So what I was picking up on there with you, Kinsey, you were saying sort of things like... Docker or Kubernetes or whatever, and these are other terms. They're not in a tight sort of environment like Scala functional programming where you can kind of go, oh my god, there's 50 words here and they all belong to one thing. I don't know what they are.
I found, particularly in the world of ops type stuff or automation type stuff, that there's so much different competing tech stacks there, and it's a real heavy product space. But people have heard the names, but also, I can do Kubernetes on Kubernetes, and what does that even mean?
It's
very confusing.
Well, I have to say, I do nothing but read about all of those kinds of things. But still, people go, I'm running, Kubernetes on OpenStack, or OpenStack on Kubernetes, or Kubernetes on OpenStack, on Kubernetes. Yeah. And you think, I just don't know.
It's like bingo, isn't it?
I
hear all the words, and I'm kind of getting lost by it. But yeah, there's a lot of products in that space, though. And then you get things like the lots of different variations or extensions on Docker too. Docker Swarm, is that different to Compose? Where do all these fit together? Maybe a kind of the bullet point and go through them is a...
My ops knowledge is awful, and I would totally appreciate any session like this. Just exactly the same thing that I hope people appreciate sessions like that in functional programming.
Yeah,
it's great.
Actually, I'd love to do that because it would be a good thing to force yourself to step back actually think about what all of these things mean. And there's some really weird stuff going on in ops these days about, as I say, that there are all sorts of complicated things that Google are doing, for example, and a lot of other people are doing, with running containers in VMs, inside containers, inside another level of VMs, inside another level of VMs. And you think, well, why? Why are you doing that? You know, what's the motivation for all of that kind of thing? Which would be quite interesting.
And then the 10 times the machine learning they're doing inside all of those things.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's been recorded now. This has got to happen. So they expect announcements forthcoming.
Did you also see the Skills in the Time of Automation post, which were basically the top 10 Coursera course? You've not read the show notes.
Sorry, I'm really bad today.
So it was basically a list of top 10 Coursera courses to look at in a time when jobs are getting automated away from people. Okay.
But they were almost all courses to do with automating jobs away from people. We can't beat them, join them. The entire thread of that.
I told a taxi driver once that I worked in logistics, automating warehouses and things. And he kept asking me questions about it. He was really interested, and the more I said, the angrier he got. And it turned out that he'd actually been laid off his last job for that exact reason, and he was so angry at me. So it's a really interesting,
So last night there was a show on TV about people taking the knowledge, London taxi drivers taking the knowledge, and you think, surely a lot of that is being dispensed with like self-driving cars at some point, but like the sat-navs and one thing and another that you get.
Yeah.
But a lot of these people are like, I've spent 5 years learning the knowledge because I know that that will take me into a whole different income bracket once I get my dream badge and I know the knowledge, and you think, I can't see this being around for...
Things don't tend to move. Yeah, one industry is moving much faster than another, and then there's that conflict.
So there, in that article, it was mostly machine learning. So it was like machine learning, Python, which is obviously related. There was a big data analytics course, an R course, sort of stats and analysis, and then a whole bunch of stuff on automation as well, on containers and things like this. So all directly supporting this notion.
We could go faster, not there was no course in becoming a performance poet or something through.
No, the machine can do that for you, it's fine.
It'll self-tune, self-heal, self-everything. So
probably tell poetry to itself, poetry that no one else understands, but it doesn't matter, because the machine's
not. So Delos Top 10 came out 2017 too, but talking about learning courses, that did prompt me into the Catacoder stuff. First time I'd seen it was earlier in the week. But there's some really good stuff in there, really nice kind of automation ops tools courses in there. So I don't know if you tried any of the Catacoder stuff. I had a very quick look. I think Dan Bryan posted it out, and that's where I picked up on it from. So
I have to say, I tried it about 2 years ago. It was very, very early,
and then
I hadn't looked back at it. It was completely transformed.
It did look really,
really do need to have a more of a play around with it.
Yeah, it looked really good and interesting.
Off the basis of a very short look at it, I have a positive and a negative thing to say.
Okay, go on.
There you go. Positive thing is you can get very quickly into a thing you want to know about. So I'm looking here on the front page, Docker and containers, brilliant. I don't know much about those. You go in and then there'd be a thing like building your first Docker container. Okay, this is a term I've heard people use, and within 4 screens, following the sort of column of text down the left and typing things in on the right, you can get that knowledge. So that's great. It's like a very, very factual, low-level to-do list kind of thing. Now you know this, now you know this. The downside of it is it falls foul, the content, I think, falls foul of... essentially, it's like, okay, first of all, we need to do X. Here's the command line to do X. Copy this into the terminal on the right. Now you have done X. Here's the command line to do Y. And that... I'm not sure. It doesn't have the sort of the repetition and generalisation you really need to grasp of it. So I think it's probably a really great tool to gain awareness of the general concepts and get your first entry point. But then don't expect to pick up everything you need to know from this. Expect to have to go and do a lot of work on your own. That's fine, right? That's probably what they're aiming for. But yeah, that was my thoughts on it.
I suppose. So the other bits and bobs that I've got down here too, I had lots of Kubernetes or learning Kubernetes links, mainly from Scala Williams. Tweaks, it appears that he's been trying to pick up Kubernetes lately, which has been I've benefited from. What else was there? Lots of HashiCorp releases that came out last week or past few weeks too. We're kind of kicking on for time a bit, so I'll jump into the and finalies. So there was Copywriter Coleman.
That was kind of cool,
interesting, nice way of doing your CV online.
Yeah.
Go on, you had a play with it then.
I thought it was really cute. Yeah.
I thought that too. Yeah. It was kind of nice tracking
the catching someone's attention, I imagine, if he was,
The hard sell.
Yeah, right.
AWS Kids poster, so you picked up on that too.
Yeah. Everybody should go and have a look at the AWS Kids poster. If only it really existed.
Yeah, quite.
I could do with that.
We could all do with that.
Having started trying to learn all this stuff myself, and like every three-letter abbreviation in the planet.
This was a toddler's bedroom poster. Introduction to AWS services.
As easy as that.
Only that existed.
Kind of coming full circle again though. So the Mitsuku chatbot, which we've talked about very briefly before in passing. We kind of talked about it when we started talking about the affinity that Echo and similar devices seem to have for male voices versus female or children's voices. But then, I think, on a very separate occasion, we'd got together and started talking about Mitsuku and how that responds to the manner in which you talk to it, and almost an ethics thing behind the chatbots of... feels a lot like Echo's make you talk very directively at things, whereas Mitsuku is much more interactive, and if you're aggressive, it will be aggressive back. You actually pointed me at the link for that, so thank you for that. How have you found playing with Mitsuku?
I find Mitsuku almost more frightening than the death bots we were talking about earlier. And so I love Mitsuku. The trouble is, I love Mitsuku. I really like talking to Mitsuku. Feels like a person, a really nice person to talk to. So Mitsuku won the Loebner Award, which was basically the best human emulating chatbot last year and also in 2013. And if you talk to Mitsuku, if you don't... So it feels like she... if you didn't know you were talking to a chatbot, you might easily not realise that you were. That's the kind of point. It's very close to winning all Turing test. You genuinely, when you look at transcripts of people talking to Mitsuku, they genuinely get almost kind of psychological transactional analysis hits, positive and negative. She's actually really nice to talk to. You feel good after talking to Mitsuku. She says nice things to you and she's interactive. She seems to genuinely be interested in what you're saying. But if you're rude to her, she'll be rude back, and people are quite genuinely feel like they have been told off. And actually, it's extraordinary, because in some ways, Mitsuku could teach humans how to interact better. I find that a little bit scary.
Which cultural bias does she respond back with? Because I'm thinking there's a very different way to responding to rudeness from, say, from Japanese friends. They've got a very different way of responding to rudeness, where they will just shut down and not interact. Versus a very kind of Western thing of, if you're rude, you will get rudeness kind of thrown back at you.
She's not rude. I mean, she doesn't swear at people. I mean, she's very, very well behaved. But she will tell you off. If you are rude, she will tell you off. She'll say, that is not acceptable. That is, that is completely not acceptable for you to behave that way. I would say the way she deals with rudeness is perfect. I wish that nobody's ever rude to me, but if they were rude to me, I wish that they would respond to it the way that Mitsuki does.
I'm
impressed.
Strong recommendation if you've not played with it, to have a go with Mitsuku too. That's my notes done. Tons and tons of events coming up, of which the next ones that are important to me are probably FlatMap Oslo and LX Scala, because we're talking there. you've got Advanced Scala course coming up in the midst of all of that too.
Yeah, it's in a couple of weeks. Scala Days Copenhagen, I'm talking there, and then Scala Italy.
Oh, that's
at the same time as Alex Scala, they almost conflict. One very important announcement since last time is that the call for papers for Scala Exchange is open.
Oh, yeah.
So if you're in the Scala world or and have anything to say about functional programming or applications of Scala or Scala stories from the trenches or whatever, head over to the Skills Matter website and get the corporate papers there.
What's next on the card for you?
So I think I am speaking about containers and orchestration at CodeMotion Amsterdam in the middle of May.
Nice.
That's my next speaking session.
Great, cool. All right, we're probably done for this time round. Thanks, that was really entertaining, really useful.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks a lot for coming on. Right, we're probably done.